From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later in the show, why Sacramento's Arena Task Force decided to go with developer David Taylor's plan over the three other proposals submitted. Also, listeners respond to recent discussions of gun control, Stockton, naturally grown food, and more. And a UC Davis professor up for one of America's top writing awards, Yi-Yun Lee, professor of English, is nominated for the Story Prize for her latest short fiction collection, Gold Boy, Emerald Girl. But first, Sacramento's water company wants to raise many of its customers' rates by well over a third for over 3 years. Why such a large increase? Joining us with information is Evan Jacobs. He's External Affairs Manager for California American Water in Northern California. Evan, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Jeffrey. Thank you for having me.
Why does California American Water want to raise its rates by such a large amount over such a short period of time?
Sure. Well, our primary focus is making investments in the infrastructure of the customers we serve in Sacramento in order to ensure that they continue to receive a safe, reliable supply of water in the coming years.
And so what does that mean? What exactly are you going to be investing in?
Well, to tell you a little bit more about our company, we have about 60,000 homes and businesses we serve in Sacramento. We serve 10 area water systems from Placer County down to Isleton. None actually in the city of Sacramento, although we do serve parts of the cities of Citrus Heights and Rancho Cordova. So we have these 10 water systems. Each one has its own unique mix of water supplies and infrastructure investment needs. The one thing that ties all of these systems together in the Sacramento area and really ties us together as a region is the need to install water meters for all of our customers.
Is that the main reason, then, why you're raising rates by a total of about 40%?
It is one of the driving factors of rates, and it's been a driving factor in our rates since 2004. In total, our meter retrofit program is about a $60 million program. We've invested about $40 million in installing water meters to date, and a big portion of this rate request is for $20 million to continue installing meters and hopefully have all 60,000 of our homes and businesses that we serve metered by 2014.
My guest is Evan Jacobs of California American Water, which is requesting a rate increase of about 40% over 3 years to many of its customers in the Sacramento region. If a lot of this increase is to install water meters, why not just bill individuals who are getting a new water meter? Why not just make them pay for their own water meter as opposed to spreading it across everyone?
Sure. Well, the way California American Water works is we are a publicly regulated utility. We're an investor-owned utility, but our rates are set, and we go through a rate-making process with the California Public Utilities Commission. They end up deciding what the final rate increase will be and how it will affect individual classes of customers. Generally, when we make investments, those costs are built into the entire customer base and are paid for by the entire customer base. In some areas, the kind of funding mechanism you're talking about where a customer has to come up with $1,000 to have their water meter installed, there are some schemes like that where water meters are being paid for that way. We put those costs in for all of our customers, and they just come out of the general rate fund because all of our improvements are paid for through our rates.
Are you installing water meters because you've been told to, or because California American Water has decided it's the right thing to do, or because customers are asking for it?
Well, we will install meters individually for customers, but in 2004, a state law was passed that required all water users in California, all urban water users in California, to have water meters installed by 2025. California American Water is moving forward with the program more quickly than the law calls for. A couple of reasons for that. One is the Public Utilities Commission believes that customers should be metered and should pay for the water they use. We also believe that the challenge with a flat rate, when every customer is paying the same amount for their water supply, there is no incentive to conserve water. There's no incentive to use water wisely. And without a meter, it can be really difficult to even know if your sprinklers are leaking or you have a toilet that's running. So providing a meter, installing a meter, and then charging metered rates allows customers a greater degree of control over their water bills because they're paying for what they use rather than paying for the average water use of their whole community.
Well, if water meters allow for more efficient use of water, then why not use those efficiencies to pay for the installation of the meters?
Sure. And over the coming years, we hope to gain some efficiencies from having water meters. It's certainly going to provide us better data in terms of what our customers need and what water they're using and how we can operate the system more efficiently. But the fact of the matter is it's a big upfront capital investment. It's almost a $60 million capital investment to put these in.
From your point of view, what are the benefits of water meters?
Well, I think the basic fairness of water meters is that you pay for what you use. We bill you for the water you use. You're not paying for water that your neighbor used or that water you did not use. You're paying for what you use. We do have a number of programs and ways that we can help customers reduce water usage once they get their water meters in. We offer a variety of rebates for things like water-efficient toilets. For toilets that were installed before 1992, you can get up to $100 for that. Clothes washers, you can get up to $150 back, plus there's some SMUD rebates that you can get in addition to get a washing machine that uses less electricity and uses less water. And we offer up to $2,000 to customers that will replace their lawn with more water-efficient landscaping.
What if someone says, I don't want a water meter?
Unfortunately, they're going to have to get one. State law requires that we install water meters for all customers. We're trying to make the process as painless as possible. Generally, customers the first year that they are due to get their water meter, we send them information about what the construction is going to look like, the steps we're going to take. We have people on the ground, job inspectors that work very closely in the neighborhoods with our individual customers and homeowner associations to give them information, prepare them for the construction. Then we wait over a year in most cases before we actually start charging the metered rates. We provide comparison bills to customers showing them how much water they're using and how much money they would have paid if they were on a metered rate. So we try to make the process as painless for possible as customers. And of course, the most important thing is we offer a lot of great conservation programs. We also offer home water surveys where an employee will come to your house, check for leaks, help you with water-saving devices, give you a variety of ways you can reduce your water use.
You said that installing the water meters is one of the driving factors behind this large proposed rate increase. What are the others?
Sure. In general, we have made a tremendous amount of capital investment and improvements in our water systems in the last 9 years. Many of our water systems in the Sacramento area had no water storage tanks. Most all of them now have large 1 to 2 million gallon water storage tanks, which increases some of our efficiencies. It also provides better fire protection and more constant pressure for our customers. We're replacing a number of aging pipelines for customers. One of our challenges in Sacramento, not just for our company, but for all water providers, is that a number of the water mains in Sacramento run through people's backyards. They're much harder to maintain, they're much harder to access than a water main that's out in the street in the public right-of-way. So we are continuing to make investments also in our distribution system to remove those pipelines where they're problematic and replace them with new pipelines. We're also in this rate case requesting about $5.7 million for water treatment plant improvements.
Okay.
So we can continue to improve the quality of our water.
Well, if all these things are needed and they cost money, why can't you just say to your customers, we're going to raise the rates because we need extra money to pay for these services?
Because in our process, the California Public Utilities Commission provides protection to our customers, and they actually have a whole division called the Division of Ratepayer Advocates that reviews each of our rate requests to make sure that the investments that are being made are necessary and prudent and to ensure that we are operating efficiently.
Okay. How does the rate-making process work? I mean, you're talking about increasing our proposed increase for 2012 and then the two years after that. This is just the beginning of 2011. How does the process work? And what kind of say do people actually have?
Sure. Well, it's about a year and a half process in total. We filed this rate request for 2012, 13, and 14 back in July of 2010. We are at the stage now where we have filed our information. We have projected what our operating costs are going to be. We have provided a list of projects that we would like to have funded through our rates. Now it's the job of the Public Utilities Commission to analyze that information and evaluate those requests. And it's similar almost to a legal case where an administrative law judge is assigned. The Division of Ratepayer Advocates acts on behalf of customers and to protect the public interest. And we go through these projects and these costs individually to determine whether they're necessary and whether they're prudent. In terms of how customers can get involved in the process, this is actually a great time to do it. We're going to be holding informational meetings this evening at 7 p.m. at the Foothill Community Center on Diablo Drive in Sacramento, and tomorrow, Tuesday, at the Fruit Ridge Community Center down on Fruit Ridge Drive in Sacramento, to tell our customers more about what we're requesting and what all is included in this rate case. On February 9th, the California Public Utilities Commission will be holding their own meetings for customers.
Now, what if the California Public Utilities Commission receives all the testimony, receives all the request information from California American Water, and then goes, you know what, this isn't needed, and they turn it down?
That is certainly a possibility. They can approve up to the full amount of our rate request or some portion of it. And that is, when we get that decision, that's what sets our budget and what sets our investment levels.
And finally, Evan, for people who just started listening in the middle of this discussion, remind us which water customers, which general areas are affected by this?
Sure. Well, Sacramento is a little bit tricky because there's over 20 different water providers in Sacramento County. The quickest way to know if you're a California American Water customer is to look at your water bill and see who it's from. We serve 10 systems everywhere from Eielton and Walnut Grove up to West Placer County. Customers in the Rosemont area receive water from us, the Antelope area, the western portion of Citrus Heights and unincorporated county around Citrus Heights.
It's kind of scattered.
It's very scattered.
Yeah.
It is a patchwork system here in Sacramento where we have all these different water providers.
Evan Jacobs is External Affairs Manager for California American Water in Northern California, which is proposing to raise its rates by about 40% over 3 years for tens of thousands of customers in the Sacramento area. And as he said, there are two meetings, one tonight, one tomorrow night, that are community information meetings in Sacramento. Evan, thanks so much for joining us.
Jeffrey, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, how Sacramento's Arena Task Force chose David Taylor's proposal over the three others. Also, listeners respond to a variety of issues, including gun control and natural food. We'll be right back. Inside from Capital Public Radio, I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up on Talk of the Nation, first reports on a crisis or tragedy often get important facts wrong, and the shooting in Tucson was an example. For a while, news organizations, including NPR, mistakenly reported that Congresswoman Giffords was dead. How should the media handle big, fast-developing stories, and what happens when they get key facts wrong? Also, when Barack Obama ran for president, he was a candidate for peace, but America is still at war, and the president chose to intensify the conflict in Afghanistan. Discussing all this is author Stephen Carter, whose latest book is The Violence of Peace, America's Wars in the Age of Obama. That's Talk of the Nation. It starts at 11 here on Capital Public Radio. Well, the four plans for a new arena go to Sacramento City Council tomorrow. You might recall we've been covering all four of those plans here on Insight. A task force that was convened by the mayor to consider the proposals announced their choice on Friday, and they opted for developer David Taylor and his partners, who plan to build an arena in the rail yards, over the three other proposals. Capital Public Radio reporter Ben Adler spoke with the co-chair of that task force called Sacramento First, and the co-chair's name is Chris Lahine. Ben Adler spoke with him on Friday.
Why do you like Taylor's proposal the best?
Well, you know, over the course of last year, we held a public hearing with the focus of identifying the goals and objectives of the Sacramento community. And what became clear to us, you know, over the course of that process is that folks, you know, are looking for a project that would potentially have a transformative economic impact on the city, particularly with regards to a site downtown. They want a project not for the sake of building an arena for the NBA or for a professional franchise, but to help move the city forward, and they want to do it in a way that's not going to result in a direct imposition of taxes on the public. And so with that criteria, you know, we reviewed projects last year, and we reviewed the projects that were submitted this year and ranked them. And ultimately, based on the criteria that we applied, the Icon Taylor proposal is the one that does match up with the criteria that we've publicly identified that's been derived from the public input. But to make clear, you know, what we reported today in the document that we entitled the Next Steps Report is, in addition to ranking the different proposals, we made clear that, you know, in our, at least in our view, that there should be a three-step process going forward. You know, one is to enter into a period of 100 or so days to be able to determine whether there is a feasible project downtown working with the Icon Taylor Group. If so, if we do come to the conclusion that there is one and that the Taylor Icon Group has met some of the requirements that would make the project feasible, to enter into an exclusive negotiating period with them to see if we can get to a place where there's a deal. And so from our perspective, you know, we believe it's critical that in addition to looking at the rankings, that people consider the process in terms of moving this entire endeavor forward. But I think it's a good day for Sacramento. I think this entire process has continued to make progress and take steps forward. And, you know, these things are not sprints. They're not even marathons. They're really more like those ultra marathons that people run. It takes a long time and a lot of work to get to the end.
Let's talk a little bit more about the group that you ranked the best, which is the Icon Taylor Group. David Taylor is a prominent downtown developer, and Icon Venue Group has built a number of sports facilities. They started working together late last year at the request of Mayor Johnson, and because of that, their proposal has by far the fewest details of any of the four groups. Did that matter?
No, you know, we made pretty clear when we were asked to reconvene that we recognized that of the four proposals, there were some that were much farther along and more extensive and comprehensive because of the amount of work that has been put into them, and there were others that, you know, were much newer to the game. You know, from our perspective, you know, there were really two projects at the end of the day that, you know, were really focused on that downtown site that we thought made the most sense, and that was Icon Taylor and the core group. And, you know, ultimately the differentiator between those two groups was the fact that in Icon Taylor, you have an icon, a group that has done successful entertainment and sports complexes around the country, if not around the globe. And in David Taylor, you had someone who has had tremendous success developing public-private partnership projects in the Sacramento area that have benefited the community of Sacramento. And so if I could use a sports analogy, putting those two together was basically the equivalent of creating an all-star backcourt, you know, for the city to be able to explore and see if we can take the next step forward. And so, look, I think that both CORE and the Icon Taylor Group had very, very serious proposals looking at the same general area and with the same general vision. But ultimately for us, a differentiator were really the backgrounds of some of the developers. And that's not to say that the other developers aren't really good and qualified and have track records of success. It's just that these two in particular and the combination of the two of them really stood out for us.
There is a third group that wants to build an arena downtown, and it's the Convergence Group, which was picked by the task force last year and went through a period of exclusive negotiations with the city. But you seem to be saying that it is now a clear step below the other two downtown proposals. Why is that?
Well, there have been some developments since then, which is that when we issued the Critical Path Report, which was the path with the report that we issued last March, and recommended that the city engage in a process with the Convergence Group. You know, at that time, we recognized that the Convergence idea was going to be a big challenge, but because it involved the swap of multiple lands. But we also recognized that it potentially represented for the public the proposal that would have very limited public support exposure, meaning that it would not really require any significant investment of public resources. And so we thought it made a lot of sense to explore that. It was certainly boosted by the fact that both the Kings and the NBA strongly endorsed it and supported it. They went through a process where they entered into a period of trying to work out an arrangement with the state and Cal Expo in particular. Were ultimately not able to do that, not because they didn't try or not because they didn't have a good idea, but ultimately it just became too difficult. And they came back to us with a different version of their original Convergence proposal. And while we certainly agree with the site that they're focusing on, i.e. the rail yards in downtown, you know, we still continue to have questions about the difficulty of doing the multi-land swap. And, you know, for what it's worth, the NBA and the Kings no longer are backing the deal. And finally, you know, a core member of their team, which was David Taylor, or who is David Taylor, obviously decided to go off in a separate direction. All of that said, I think the community has benefited enormously from the work that they put in at their own cost. It was a real idea. And as I said earlier, you know, these are not sprints. These are going to have multiple chapters to them If you look around the country, historically, these are 5, 10, 12-year projects to get going, and they take twists and turns, and I think Sacramento is going through that process, and I think that the Convergence Group contributed significantly to what we know now and our ability to move forward.
And then the fourth group is the Natomas Entertainment and Sports Complex proposal. Of course, the task force has demonstrated from, I think from the start as part of your criteria, that you're focused on downtown. Natomas has, in many ways, a more in-depth proposal than the other groups. Is the location the only issue you see with it?
That really is, you know, we made this clear in the report, which is, and we made it clear in the Critical Path report as well, which was the earlier report, which is that, you know, Natomas has clearly presented a well-thought-out, comprehensive proposal with real expertise and credible people attached to it. But ultimately, you know, for us, it doesn't address that core criteria that we have established, which is looking at a facility that will be in the downtown area, because we believe that that is the type of facility that could have a catalytic impact, a transformative impact on the economics of the city in terms of where the city is going in the future, in terms of creating jobs very quickly that will represent a significant number. And so, yes, Natomas had a great idea and a great vision, but ultimately for us, given the criteria that was established, and again, that criteria came out of a public process, which is to look for a downtown economically transformative project. Now, ultimately, you know, these are decisions for the city council and for the mayor to make in terms of what public policy direction that the city wants to go in. But, you know, our charge from the mayor was to involve the public in the process, identify criteria, and then ultimately look at and review the proposals based on the public input. And that's what we've done.
You mentioned the city council, and they will meet on Tuesday. You'll present the report to the council, and council members can decide which way they want to go. And finally, Chris Lehane, the co-chair of Mayor Johnson's Arena Task Force. Last year, the task force did pick the Convergence Group, and it was a proposal that at the time had a lot of loose ends. What's different this time around with Mr. Taylor's proposal with ICON in that there are a lot of open questions, too?
Sure, and every step in this process is designed to move the overarching campaign forward. As I said, I think there will probably be starts and fits, but the general idea is to make sure that we learn, we as a community, Sacramento as a community learns, so that we can apply this information going forward. I think what is potentially the most significant differentiator right now with this particular project is the fact that you are combining two really interesting entities. You have a group in ICON that has had enormous success, one of the leaders in the entertainment and sports complex development space, you know, in the country, if not the world, making the decision that it is certainly worthwhile to take a hard look and pursue a project in Sacramento, which is great news for those who are trying to figure out whether there is a there. And then secondly, them coupling with David Taylor, who has had a real track record of success, particularly on public-private partnerships in the Sacramento area. I think the combination of those two, you know, is going to create some real synergy that should benefit the city. And I think at the end of the day, they are going to work with the city. They made very clear in their proposal publicly to us and in our informal meetings that they can determine in 90 days whether they believe there is a feasible project. And I think that 90-day window, you know, gives us some certainty, some visibility in terms of being able to come to a conclusion of whether it will work with them, and if not, whether there is a different route to get to a feasible project. And again, at the end of the day, this is going to be a long journey, and we're going to take a lot of steps to get there. And each step we take, we want to learn more and more so we can apply it so we ultimately get to the objective.
Chris Lehane co-chairs Mayor Johnson's Arena Task Force. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
Chris Lehane was speaking with Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler. It's time to hear what listeners think about some of our recent guests and topics, including the arena. With me is Insight's Jen Picard. Jen, welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
On Facebook, we asked for ideas on where to put a new arena in Sacramento. I read several ideas last week, but more came in. Steve said,
I don't care, so long as no public funds or land assets are spent on it, and the boiler works, and erecting shops are preserved for the Railroad Museum.
Kevin weighed in, too.
Downtown. Let's not let fear derail opportunity in our city. Let's all step up and make things happen.
Also on Facebook, we asked you about food because of our conversation with livestock rancher Nicolette Han Nieman, whose husband Bill founded the famous natural meat company Neiman Ranch. Our question was, do you make an effort to eat organic and or local food? Is sustainable food important to you? Well, Sylvia replied,
I definitely make an effort to eat local more than organic, simply because organic items can become pricey. I appreciate the hard work of local farmers, which is why I choose to support them versus big supermarket chains. I think if people had a better understanding of how food travels, the handling of these products, and the energies and resources wasted in transport, people may think twice about purchasing navel oranges from Chile rather than from Auburn, California.
We also heard from Chad, who listens online a couple of thousand miles away.
It's easy to eat locally during the growing season, but here in Iowa, it is fairly tough to eat local fresh produce now. It was minus 20 degrees Fahrenheit this morning. I raise pigs for a natural pork market, and it definitely costs me more per pig than my neighbors producing by more conventional means.
Another recent topic and insight was how colleges and universities deal with students who might be mentally ill and who might be at risk of causing violence. We talked with the head of the Student Crisis Response team at UC Davis, which meets regularly to discuss cases, and that spoke to a listener called Stan.
I thought the recent interview with Donald Dudley of UC Davis was the most useful and practical discussion I've heard yet after the Arizona shooting. Great job.
Last week, we had another discussion inspired by the shooting in Tucson. My guests were Amanda and Nick Wilcox of Nevada County. Their daughter, Laura, was shot dead by a mentally ill gunman 10 years ago this month. The Wilcoxes are advocates of stricter gun control and were even before their daughter's murder. Amanda Wilcox spoke about what she called the gun show loophole, allowing people to cross state lines to buy guns they can't buy in their home state. A listener called Mitch, apparently from Nevada, wrote to say,
what is portrayed as the gun show loophole is either a violation of the Federal Gun Control Act and so is already illegal, or is a legal private transfer between residents of the same state who are legally permitted to own firearms.
Mitch also commented on Nick Wilcox's observation that armed civilians don't necessarily know how to respond correctly and safely in the heat of a dangerous moment. At least one of the people on the scene in Tucson was armed but didn't use his gun, although reportedly almost fired it by mistake at an innocent bystander.
As the man in Tucson made the correct decision at the time, it is obvious that a citizen can and has made the correct decision in these very circumstances. Furthermore, a vast majority of adults make similar decisions, often reflexively, every day while driving their vehicles. At 65 miles per hour, a vehicle travels nearly 100 feet per second. Education, not legislation, is needed to prevent further senseless tragedies.
And on Friday, I talked with photographer Kirk Crippens about his exhibit, Foreclosure USA, which is running at University of the Pacific. It's about the impact of the housing crisis on Stockton. A listener called Valerie thought the theme of Crippen's work and his comments and insight were one-sided.
I do not question the value of his exhibition, but Stockton should not only be defined by its foreclosure rate. Over time, this city will recover. If Crippens has developed an appreciation for the city through his work here, I would hope that he would express this by offering a comment or two regarding the beauty of the landscape, the richness of the agricultural region, or the notable institutions and landmarks that the residents of Stockton celebrate.
I separately heard from Kirk Crippens. He said that the talk he gave in Stockton on the University of the Pacific campus on Friday evening was full, and a TV feed was set up for the overflow crowd. Tell us what you think about Insight. You can email us at insight@capradio.org, or you can visit us on Facebook, or you can tweet me. You can also listen to previous segments of Insight in our online archive at capradio.org/insight. Jen, thanks.
You're very welcome.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, some of the stories behind all those official portraits of governors at the state capitol. You're listening to Inside from Capitol Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tomorrow, coverage of tonight's State of the State speech by the new governor of Nevada. The state is dealing with a deep recession and a big budget deficit. Governor Sandoval says he will not raise taxes. That story and more tomorrow morning on Inside. Well, one of the many things to see at the state capitol here in Sacramento is the collection of official portraits of California's governors. The most famous of those paintings is the colorful, slightly abstract portrait of Jerry Brown when he was first governor, but there are many other paintings of note there, and they tell us something about political power in California and the people who've held it over the decades. Joining us with some stories behind California's gubernatorial portraits is Vito Scromo, who's building manager of the California State Capitol, and he's worked with the official portraits for many years now. Vito Scromo, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much.
Are all of California's governors represented on the walls of the Capitol?
All except the previous governor, Governor Schwarzenegger. His portrait hasn't been dedicated yet, but yet up to that point, all of them have been painted and hung in the west wing of the Capitol.
And is it actually a requirement that there will be a portrait of the governor?
What it is, there is a 1931 law that allocates a portion of the state budget for the governor to commission an artist. And upon completion of that, and he gets that money after he leaves, by the way, the portrait has to be hung in the West Wing. It doesn't specifically state that he has to have a portrait done, but it's available for him to use for a portrait. And each one of the governors up to this point has done one.
The portrait of Jerry Brown is probably the most famous. Is that the one that people ask about the most when they come to the Capitol?
It's not only the one that's asked the most, but I think it's one of the most popular pieces of artwork or part of the building that has existed in the building. It seems to attract a lot of curiosity. People who view it coming through see the difference between that portrait and other portraits and ask a lot of questions, even if they're not familiar with who he was or who he is right now. So it is probably the most popular attraction in the building.
You were working at the Capitol, I believe, when the portrait was done, which was in the early 80s. What was the reaction of people in the Capitol when the painting of Jerry Brown arrived?
Well, actually, I arrived a few years later, but the portrait has solicited strong responses. It's either people have appreciate it and acknowledge it, or people disagree with the way it was painted and feel that it's inappropriate. So you get a kind of a polarization, people who either love it or hate it. I really haven't heard anybody saying it's a portrait that's okay for them. It solicits strong responses from visitors.
Yeah. My guest is Vito Scromo. He's building manager of the California State Capitol, and we're talking about the collection of official portraits of California's governors that are on display there. Governor Gray Davis broke with tradition a little bit in his portrait, not as dramatically as Jerry Brown did, but tell us how Governor Davis broke with tradition.
Well, he broke with tradition in two ways, main ways. If you see his portrait, it's hung, again, in the third floor gallery of the West Wing. His portrait shows him on the exterior, outside, which is not uncommon because we've had a few other governors, Governor C.C. Young, Governor Reagan, portrayed themselves on outside, and Governor Wilson on the outside of the Capitol. But his portrait is not only portrayed outside, but it's portrayed outside, not next to the Capitol, by a piece of land in Monterey that he helped save. And then, again, the other unusual feature is he is not wearing a jacket. His jacket is draped over his hand. And I think the interpretation there, at least for me, is that obviously he doesn't want to be remembered for what took place at the Capitol because he was recalled, number one. Number two, he was always criticized as not being too formal. Actually, his criticism was he was too formal. And by portraying himself with the jacket over his hand, he's kind of trying to leave a message that, no, I am accessible, I am formal, let my hair down. So it definitely broke with what has been done with, portraits of, governors outside.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned where it was because I've seen that portrait and I've wondered where he was standing. It looked like he was about to play golf in Scotland or something like that, but it's in Monterey.
It's in Monterey, yeah. He saved a piece of land there. So again, these portraits have evolved from where they were intended to be, which was just to capture their image. To me, what the story here is the portraits, if you see some of the early ones, are very formal, very serious, and they were intended to be so. But the newer portraits the last few years kind of give you more of a deep, more serious insight in who the person is and what they want to leave behind. So they've evolved from a kind of a superficial capturing of an image to an insight into the philosophy of the man.
You mentioned how Governor Davis broke with tradition by not wearing his jacket and also by being outside, although other governors had done that. The first governor to be to break with the tradition of being inside the Capitol was who?
C.C. Young. And it's interesting because we look at it today and people don't see the controversy. But if you look at the preceding governor's portraits, they were done inside, very dark and somber, by their desk, very serious, not smiling, and in a more, kind of formal pattern. If you look at his portrait, it's done outside, very bright, very casual, with his hand in his pocket, and he's smiling. The interpretation is that he is taking his job not serious enough. So the criticism at the time was that this is not dignified enough for the governor. So it might not seem controversial in our eyes today, but in 1947, when it was unveiled, it was extremely controversial.
Governor Earl Warren also angered some people with his portrait. What was that about?
Well, and it is. It was one, again, that caused controversy. Earl Warren was governor before term limits for three gubernatorial periods, and he was selected by Eisenhower to be the Chief Justice. So when he left and he assumed the position of Chief Justice for the federal courts, his portrait came back after he left as the Chief Justice, not as the governor. And so the legislature and the media portrayed that as not correct, in as much as it should have been portrayed as him as the governor, not as the Chief Justice. So that was extremely controversial.
Because it seemed like to some like he was disrespecting the office of governor.
Exactly. Like he didn't take it serious that even though he held the position for three almost complete terms, he chose to be portrayed in California's history and in the Capitol as not as the governor, but as the Chief Justice. So it was what they perceived as a slap in the face.
Do you have a personal favorite among all the gubernatorial portraits?
Actually, what I love is, like I said, Jerry Brown's portrait that was done by Don Bacardi, who passed away a few years ago because...
No, actually, Don didn't. We just had him on our show a few weeks ago.
Oh, I thought he passed away. Yeah, no, I thought there was
As it happens, I know that.
No, that's good. We had been told that, but I guess you're right. But it's interesting because if you look at the portraits that have been done up to that point, even though they've gradually break with tradition, that portrait conveys more of who the man is and what he was trying to do. And on that portrait, besides people focus heavily on the style, what is on there is a segment of his last State of the State speech, which talks about how technology will lead us into the future. So it really gives you more of a personal call or insight into the man. And that's my favorite, just because, again, it reveals more who this person was at the time he was governor.
As you mentioned when we started, the one governor who's not on the wall so far is the recent former governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger. What can you tell us about the process, the timeline for Governor Schwarzenegger being on the walls of the Capitol?
Well, you know, the usual process is this. When they leave, they usually select an artist, and then they go through a series of poses. The time frame for something like that usually takes up to a year. So that when they're completed, the portrait is completed, the current administration gets a notification that they would like to dedicate it. And then there's arrangements being made depending on where they want to have it. The process usually takes over a year. And the last major dedication, Governor Davis, took place in the first floor rotunda. So usually it's about a year and a half away before the portraits are dedicated. Although that's not been the case over the history of the portraits. Governor Merriam, who was governor in the late 30s, actually had his portrait done before he left office. He paid for it himself during the Great Depression, and he hung it in his office before he left. So like I said, there's been always changes to normal, what we consider protocol.
Vito Scromo, building manager of the California State Capitol, talking with us about the collection of official gubernatorial portraits of former governors at the California State Capitol. Vito, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to Insight from Capitol Public Radio. When we come back, a professor at UC Davis is up for one of America's top writing awards. We'll be right back. You're listening to Inside from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later today on Capital Public Radio News, how Governor Brown's proposed budget would affect veterans. He's proposing to eliminate general fund support for county veteran service offices. Also, it's the first day back at Sacramento State, and for the first time in several semesters, the student body has grown in size. The number of students admitted fell the previous two semesters because of state budget cuts. A UC Davis professor is up for one of America's top writing awards. Yi-Yun Lee, professor of English, is nominated for the Story Prize for her latest short fiction collection, Gold Boy, Emerald Girl. She's best known so far in her career for her novel, The Vagrants, set in her native China during the Cultural Revolution. Last year, Yi-Yun Lee made the New Yorker magazine's list of the nation's best young fiction writers, and she joined us around that time. And I asked if she had known she was being considered by the New Yorker as one of the top 20 fiction writers under 40.
Well, at some point, they told me I had to turn in something for them to read. So at that time, I knew that I was, you know, in the run.
I read the story about the process in the Los Angeles Times, which said that some young writers were quite anxious about whether or not they would be on the list. Was it on your mind? Were you concerned?
I wasn't very anxious. I was a little, well, I was caught off guard because they told me I had to come up with something right away. And so I...
To publish in the magazine?
No, to show them, to, I guess, to see if they would like to publish. So I think I spent a lot of energy just writing that story. And then it happened, I was traveling around the time, so there was no time to get nervous.
And what happened after you were named? Because The New Yorker is such a prestigious literary magazine and has been for decades.
Well, it's a wonderful thing to be called young. I'm very happy to be called young. Yeah, it's a great thing. It's great to be on that list.
Yeah. My guest is Yi-Yun Lee. Her new book is a collection of stories called Gold Boy, Emerald Girl. You seem to split your time between writing short stories and novels. Your previous book was a novel. You've gone back to short stories for this one. Mm-hmm. Do you plan to continue that way?
Yes, that's pretty much my plan because I really love both forms, nonfiction and short stories, and they offer different things. And I also have the habit of when I write a novel, when I'm working on a novel, I always write stories just to the side. So it's sort of the plan I'm going to have.
And at what point do you know that a story is going to be a short story as opposed to a novel? Or is that obvious right away?
That's a very good question. I think it's obvious because, you know, I spent like 2 years coming up with a novel idea. And by the time you are working on a novel, it's already a whole long journey. Well, the stories, they come very fast to you. When the ideas come to you, you just have to execute them right away. And that oftentimes is a story idea.
Yeah. You were born in China and you lived there for a good part of your life. Have you written fiction in your native language?
No, I've never written in Chinese. I've never written fiction in Chinese.
Have you any intention, expectation that you will?
No, I don't think so. I think part of the reason I became a writer was I started writing in English, which is a second language, which became a first language in writing. And that, to me, was a major step.
It's your first language in writing?
Yes, because I process my thinking mostly in English. Well, a lot of daily life, you know, apples and dinner, I still think about them in Chinese, but big topics, I think, in English.
What language is spoken in your home?
Chinese.
So you spend a lot of your time thinking and speaking in Chinese, but you switch to English when you're being Yi-Yun Lee, the author.
That's about right. There's a switch there. I think when I'm in that storytelling mode, I'm in English. My whole world is functioning in English.
How do you think it would work if you actually did write a novel or a short story in Chinese? Would your writing style be different?
That's such a highly hypothetical question. That,
well, it's hypothetical, but you are Chinese, a native Chinese speaker.
Well, I think I would be just less willing to be more straightforward, if I could say that.
Really?
Yes, I think with Chinese, you had this whole history growing up with your native language. And for me, my history with my native tongue is I try not to say what I meant to say in Chinese.
And that's because of political circumstances in the past?
It was partly political circumstance, partly, you know, family. Within the family, you don't say things. You say things you don't mean to say, right? So yes. It's always hard to maneuver around your native tongue.
Well, I don't speak a word of Chinese, but just about a week ago, I happened to hear an interview on NPR of this American woman who had been in China, and she was talking about how very direct the Chinese language is, that there are no frills, it just gets straight to the point. So I thought it was interesting when you said that you would be less straightforward if you wrote in Chinese.
That's so funny. I wonder why she made that comment, because it's a straightforward language, but when you, even if you use a straightforward language, you can use it to hide yourself pretty well. I imagine that's any language you can do.
My guest is Yi Yun Lee. She is an author. Her new book is a collection of stories called Gold Boy, Emerald Girl. She's also well known for her first novel, The Vagrants. She was born in China. She also teaches English at UC Davis. This collection of stories, how did you decide to call it after one of the particular stories in it, Gold Boy, Emerald Girl? There are a whole bunch of stories in it. You could have called it after any one of them.
Yes. So Gold Boy, Emerald Girl is a Chinese expression that I actually translated from Chinese to English. And original meaning, I mean, original phrase means like a perfect couple who the man looks very beautiful, I mean, handsome, the woman is beautiful. But in the story, the Gold Boy, Emerald Girl, there are actually more than one couple. They could all be Gold Boy, Emerald Girl, but they were all mismatched in a way. And that seems to be in every one of the stories, or every one of the stories I've ever written, is there's always a surface which is gold or emerald, but then there's something underneath that surface, which is what I'm writing about.
Your novel, The Vagrants, was set in China, and many of the stories in Gold Boy, Emerald Girl are set in China. And yet, you say that English is now your writing language. Do you think you're going to start increasingly set stories in the United States?
You know, I noticed that my latest stories are taking place in America, even without my being, you know, making the decision very consciously. Yes, I think America is seeping into my stories.
Where do the ideas come from? You said that you've started noticing, without intending to make it happen, that the stories are starting to be set in the United States. But where are these ideas coming from? Are you seeking out ideas and that's what comes out? Or do they just pop in your head when you're buying a cup of tea?
Well, ideas happen all different ways. You know, you read something in the news or someone tells you a story, or you overhear a conversation. So I think ideas are pretty much everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's where you take that idea, where you take it to. It's often interesting to me.
And with all the changes in China, there must be no end of interesting stories to tell from China today.
Yes, I think one thing I noticed, like when you ask about like America coming into my world, into my fiction a little bit more, is the world is becoming a smaller world today. It's like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when I left China, China was a very far away country. It was not known here, you know, well known here, and calling them was expensive, but the world is becoming smaller. And a lot of Americans go there. A lot of people come here. And in a way, I think there are more stories to tell because we're more intimate, like we understand each other a little bit more.
Will your book, Gold Boy, Emerald Girl, be translated into Chinese and sold in China?
I don't think so. The translation is not going to happen.
I see. Yi Yun Lee, her new book, it's a collection of short stories, Gold Boy, Emerald Girl, it's called. Earlier this year, she was named one of the New Yorker magazine's 20 under 40, the top 20 fiction writers under the age of 40 in the nation. And she teaches at UC Davis. Yi Yun Lee, thank you so much for joining us on Insight.
Thank you very much for having me again.
Yi Yun Lee was recently named one of the three finalists for this year's Story Prize for Gold Boy, Emerald Girl. The winner will be announced March 2nd. And that's Insight for today. Our associate producer, Liz Cazares. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We'll be back tomorrow. At Insight, we have one goal.
It's appropriate that I provide an insight.
That's a tough question.
You know what you're talking about.
To get the answers you want to hear.
Well, that's true.
With Insight.
From interesting people of every stripe.
We're here with Jeffrey Kallsen.
You have done your homework, Jeffrey.
Interesting question.
Oh, you hit it right on the head, Jeff.
Yes.
I like your accent, by the way.
I'm Jeffrey Kallsen. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.